I'm glad you dance with me, Amy.
Of course. It's a jam.
It is a jam. Hello, everyone. I'm Kimberly Adams. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we make today make sense. It is Friday. We made it to Friday, November the 3rd. Kai is out today, but as you can see, I have my dancing buddy with me here, Amy Scott. Hey, Amy.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for joining us on the podcast and everybody on the YouTube live stream. It's Friday, thank goodness. And that means it's time for Economics on Tap, our weekly happy hour special.
And happy hour means cocktails, alcoholic or non, whatever your pleasure may be. We're going to have some cocktails, see what you all are drinking, talk about what we're drinking, then get to some news, take a break, then play a round of half full, half empty. So let's start from the top. Amy, what are you drinking today?
Well, Kimberly, thanks to Tony Wagner's prodding yesterday, I had to plan ahead and I decided to make a hot toddy. So
nice.
I'm showing the audience.
Oh, what a cute mug.
This is my special WYPR WTMD mug, Baltimore shout out.
Aww.
Yeah, it's gotten, the weather has turned, shall we say. It's gotten a little chilly. So I made my first hot toddy of the season on Halloween night and liked it so much, I decided
spooky.
To make another one. Yeah.
So how do you make your hot toddies? What do you put in them?
Well, I kind of like Google the recipe every time because I don't make them that often. But this is just hot water, brown sugar, bullet bourbon, and lemon juice. And then today I stuffed a couple of cloves in the lemon like wedge that I put in for a little extra. So yeah.
Fancy, fancy.
How about you?
I have I feel badly. I don't actually know how to pronounce it. I think it's a Boulevardier. It's something fancy. Anyway, last week, I'm stuck on the microphone. So last week I was kind of at a loss and I asked ChatGPT to I put in all the ingredients that I had in my bar at the moment and asked for a recipe that was Halloween themed and it gave me a cocktail. So this week I went back to the same ChatGPT conversation and I was like, what's another cocktail I can make with these ingredients that's not Halloween themed?
That's an excellent use of AI, Kimberly.
Hey,
I endorse.
Let the robot overlords make us cocktails. Anyway.
It's the least they can do for us.
It's the least they can do. So a Boulevardier, I think, is how it's pronounced. But anyway, let's see what everybody else is drinking. If you want to look in the
maybe
YouTube
someone can
live
weigh in with
chat.
The pronunciation.
Pronunciation. I'll look in the Discord.
All right. So we've got somebody drinking a diet cream soda. Nice.
Oh, nice.
Somebody else drinking decaf coffee, trying to be nice to my tummy. I love it. let's see.
Somebody in the Discord is drinking licorice iced tea because they... Oh, sorry. No, just licorice tea because they caught a cold for the first time in 3.75 years. I'm so sorry, Verbena.
Whoa. Yeah, that's a long stretch,
Michael's,
though.
Yeah, good for you. Michael's drinking Tanqueray and tonic. Gin is the devil. Not going to... No. Anyway.
Well, that said, Nathan Schmidt is shaking up a martini, so I assume it's gin.
A gin or a
he
vodka martini, though. Okay, so let's get to news. Amy, why don't you go first as my light flickers on and off?
Uh-oh. Yeah, I hope it stays on. Well, at first I want to give a shout-out to Morning Edition's coverage of the Israel-Hamas war. I've been listening every morning as I drive to my bar class, and I always have to pause in the parking lot.
Your bar
because
class?
Bar, it's an exercise thing.
Oh,
that I
okay.
Do.
Why? I was like, are you studying law? Are you about to take the
I know,
bar
it sounds
exam?
Like, it, right. It sounds like either I'm drinking and learning to shake cocktails or, yeah, B-A-R-R-E.
Okay.
Anyway, we can cut this. As I'm driving to my exercise class in the morning, I listen to their coverage. And today there were reports from people who were finally exiting Gaza into Egypt through the border crossing. And it was just incredibly moving and sad. So, you know, I think those of our regular listeners know we're not NPR. They're close neighbors, shall we say, relatives. Just a shout out to their coverage. So I saw this one on Grist. The United Nations is out this week with a new report saying that developing countries will need between $215 $1.387 billion every year this decade to adapt to changes caused by the climate crisis. And that's much higher than the UN estimated even just last year. So it shows how much more dire the crisis is becoming. It's also far more than wealthy countries have been providing. In 2021, developing countries received just $21 billion total for climate adaptation. So they need 10 to 18 times that. And that's what the UN calls the adaptation finance gap. As I'm sure you know, there's been a huge debate over how the countries that have really caused the climate crisis by emitting the most greenhouse gases should help these less developed countries pay for the damage. They're often paying the biggest price. They're more vulnerable to things like storm damage and sea level rise and extreme heat. And this report comes out just as world leaders will be gathering later this month for the next COP climate conference, COP28 in Dubai, where that issue, I'm sure, will be front and center again. At the last COP, which was COP27 in Egypt, wealthy countries agreed to set up a fund to compensate developing countries for the loss and damage created by climate change, which was a huge deal. Countries have been pushing that for decades. But now that process is actually stalled over debates about how it will be funded, who will manage it. And so I think this report comes at a crucial time for countries that are trying to figure out how to prevent loss by, of course, mitigating the effects of climate change, speeding up the transition away from fossil fuels. But also, if you pay money to adapt first, you reduce those losses. So things like early warning systems, investing in more resilient buildings and infrastructure, and the GRIS story that we'll link to cites a study that found that for every dollar spent on adaptation, we can save as much as $10 in potential damage. So worth the investment, yeah, but it's going to be awfully expensive.
I mean, do you see any willingness on behalf of the countries that caused this to, you know, increase funding in this direction or to take responsibility?
You know, what's interesting is that I think it was $21 billion I cited in 2021. That was actually a reduction from the year before. And it was as the global pandemic was costing countries a lot of money. They were kind of turned inward. I don't know. I think people saw that step in Egypt as real progress when they agreed to create at least a fund. But it's going to take a lot more than, you know, promises to really fulfill that obligation.
Yeah. Oh, boy. I think that is going to be such an interesting story to follow in the years to come, sort of who pays for the cost. And I know that there was a story out where one of the early alarmists about climate change, you know, came out with a paper along with a bunch of other scientists saying it's happening faster than we thought. We've already kind of blown past 1.5 degrees. And it's, you know, it's a serious thing. And we live in a privileged position to, you know, not necessarily have felt it directly here, even though other parts of the country have. But pretty soon it's going to be all of us.
Yeah. Well, we are feeling it here. And I think that's what will finally get people
acknowledge
off their couches and do something about it.
Yeah.
So,
well, I've got one political story, one political-ish story. So people who have been listening know that Kai and I have been talking quite a bit about Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville's blockage of many military confirmations. And, you know, the Senate is still trying to find ways around this. But there's a very interesting article that I came across in Roll Call, kind of taking a look at the advise and consent function of the Senate more broadly when it comes to confirmations, because this is a role for the Senate in the Constitution. And, you know, it's important, but the fact that this could be held up over and over again by one person in this way, you know, makes people take a look at this a little bit differently. So I'm looking at this. The Senate Armed Services Committee estimates it considers 50,000 promotions each Congress. And a 2023 report from the Congressional Research Service put the number of military appointments and promotions at approximately 65,000 per two-year Congress. But the congressional resume, the official tally of what the legislative branch does, says there were closer to 40,000 military nominations in the 117th. The idea that a committee of 25 senators is doing any kind of actual vetting for 40,000 to 65,000 officers is absurd on its face. So why do it? Because the Constitution says so. But it goes on to say that the framers never imagined a system like we have today. And it's not just military confirmations that have to go through the Senate. There are other confirmations on the executive side that have to go through confirmations. And, you know, it's just, I've been so caught up in sort of the day-to-day of it, I hadn't sort of stepped back to think about the process overall. And I thought this was really an interesting analysis of the advise and consent role of the Senate and, you know, whether or not it needs another look in light of the realities of how our government runs today. Because that's a lot of, you know, different, that's a lot of confirmations. Oh, it looks like we lost Amy's video, but can we still hear you, Amy?
No, I can still hear you. I can still hear you. I think my Zoom just shut down. Yeah, but it is kind of bananas that so many things that were never envisioned by the founders, we, you know, adhere to.
Like the two of us hosting a radio show or existing with autonomy.
Yeah, that was never envisioned.
Never.
Go ahead. All right, I think I'm back. Back on the video. Hi, everybody.
Fantastic. Okay. I have one other one. So this is my politics-ish story because it involves yet another federal agency, the Federal Trade Commission. So the Federal Trade Commission is in this big antitrust lawsuit with Amazon. And as part of that process, we get to see all these nice little legal filings. They give us details about the FTC's investigation into Amazon and things that they learn. One of them was, according to The Hill, Amazon made more than $1 billion in excess profits by employing a secret algorithm codenamed Project Nessie that inflated prices, according to a newly unredacted portion of the FTC's antitrust lawsuit. So basically what this did is Amazon used this program between, allegedly, 2015 and 2019 to raise prices by predicting whether other online stores would follow in Amazon price hikes. And using these predictions, according to the FTC, Amazon would raise prices when it was most likely to be followed and would maintain the higher price after other online stores adopted similar price hikes. They would stop doing it around the holidays when more people were watching what the prices were doing. But according to The Hill, Amazon reportedly used this secret algorithm to set prices for more than 8 million items purchased by customers in 1 month in 2018. That year, the e-commerce giant estimated Project Nessie brought in an additional $334 million in profits. So that lawsuit continues to bring out really interesting things about how Amazon operates as a company, and also just, you know, how we as consumers shop online and how easily that can be managed. Sorry, Jasper.
I couldn't help but wonder, is Project Nessie a reference to Nessie, the Loch Ness Monster? I mean, if so, that just makes it even more kind of cringe, right? It's like stealth.
But does it really exist?
Good point. Yeah, no one will ever know. I'm a
Except
believer.
For the Federal Trade Commission.
I see you, Amazon.
Okay, well, that is it for the news for now. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to play a round of half full, half empty, and so we will be right back.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
Okay, great. Now it's time to play Half Full, Half Empty. Drew is out today, so we have a special guest host with a wonderful voice, Marketplace tech producer Daniel Shin. Hey, Daniel.
Hello, friends.
I love hearing Daniel's voice.
I want you to be hosting like a late night jazz show or something, Daniel. But
that would
you
require,
probably already have one.
I mean,
don't
that
you?
Would require me having a personality or anything. But I'm
oh
not, I'm
no,
not that
Daniel,
fun.
That's not true. You have a great personality. Anyway, that's another conversation for later. Let's do this game. Go ahead.
I'm about to give you, or rather, we're going to start, I guess, with a really controversial topic. Are you half full or half empty on our phones getting bigger?
Oh, that was a great interview. I am half empty.
No, you have to
I'm
tell everybody empty. About it.
Oh, yeah. So yesterday, Kai talked to someone who'd written a piece kind of in search of a small phone and basically couldn't find one anymore. The closest we can get is like a folding giant Galaxy, I think he talked about. So it, you know, it goes in your pocket, but then when you open it, it's like too large for most hands to hold. And I can relate. I actually have like smallish hands, and I still have a smaller phone, partly for that reason. I want to be able to like actually hold it in my hand. I do miss the flip phone, although I do like what I can do and watch on this screen.
You can still get flip phones.
That's what I hear, but yes. Apparently it's getting harder to find, or maybe phones that have functionality.
Fair.
So what about you, one Kimberly?
What was the question? Was it, are we half full or half empty on bigger phones or smaller phones?
Bigger phones.
Half empty. I also prefer a smaller phone, which is one of the reasons that I consistently kept buying like the iPhone 6S or the iPhone SE refurbished over and over and over again. A, because it was cheaper, but B, because like I just didn't, it doesn't fit in the very limited pockets that women get anyway. They do not fit when they get much bigger. And so I like held on, I think it's still sitting over here. I still have like an iPhone SE that I use sort of day to day, but then I broke down and I got a different phone that's one of the bigger iPhones to use for, you know, like TikTok videos and, you know, taking photos and video for our social media stuff that we do for Marketplace. By the way, we're on TikTok now. If you're, you know, okay with the cybersecurity component, go follow us. So anyway, half
by
empty.
We, some what's of us, next? Some of us are on TikTok. You know, you mentioned the camera. That's one thing that I would not want to give up. I mean, the cameras just get better and better. And I'm the kind of person who loves to take pictures spontaneously, but would never drag a big old Nikon around. So if it has to be a trade-off and I need a big phone for the big camera, I guess I'm okay with it.
All right, what's the next one?
Number two, are you half full or half empty on the concept of super commuting?
Uh-oh.
So this is the story about people who travel extreme distances to get to and from work, trying to take advantage of remote work where they don't have to come into the office every day and live someplace cheaper, bigger, and then just commute extraordinarily long distances, sometimes taking a flight every day to get where they need to go for work, or not every day, taking a flight whenever they have to go to work. I'm half empty, don't love the carbon footprint of it, but I also get it because, you know, it's expensive to live in these places. I also, on the other hand, though, I feel like the people who often end up with the kinds of jobs where they can do the super commutes tend to skew a little bit wealthier, more white collar. And so I'm half empty. I think like either get a job where you can work fully remotely or, you know, try to live where you work as best you can. Although if you've got like caregiving responsibilities for a relative out of state, like I get that too.
Yeah, I would say I'm half empty as well. I think, I mean, we know what the toll that commuting takes on people's lives and health and the aforementioned climate crisis. So, but I'm also, you know, so many people are forced or have been forced into really long commutes just because of housing affordability challenges, having to live further and further from their jobs. And some people are doing super commutes like involuntarily, right? So,
yeah,
I just think if we can figure out ways to limit at least driving a lot, that would be good. And flying to your job. I mean, I get it. Sometimes, you know, families are separated and there's a period where you'd have to commute to your job long distances, but I don't know. Have I really?
Yeah.
That's why it's called half empty, half full. It's, I don't have to fully commit. I can just be sort of wishy-washy about it.
We can be halfsies. Although B. Patton says in the YouTube chat, long commutes equals time for Marketplace podcasts.
Hey, you know, that's a good point, B. Patton. Cheers to that.
Good job. Good job. All right. What's the next one, Daniel?
I'm afraid you can't be wishy-washy with this next one.
Uh-oh.
Half full or half empty on company-mandated cybersecurity trainings, which I assume you've all already done.
I did mine the day after I got the email. Thank you very much.
Oh, my goodness. You're putting me to shame.
Have you done yours yet?
Well, let me just say, we recently changed to these shorter quarterly trainings. I'm half full on that. Please, more of this. You can, like,
as
get it done
to
in 15
the
three minutes.
Hour ones just a little that chunk. We used to
yes.
do.
Right, because, I mean, the other one we do on harassment is, it's like the same content every year, but they change the actors and the backgrounds, and it's like, come on, people, we're content creators.
They added some non-binary folks.
That's true. Every year it does get a little bit more progressive on the gender stuff. That's true. But it's still like, you know, I kind of feel like I've seen this movie before and it takes a lot of time out of your day. So I think breaking it up into more digestible chunks is a lot better.
So despite myself, I am half full on this because some of these phishing attacks are getting incredibly sophisticated. And with all of these, the AI factoring into it, and some of the stuff I see that my mom gets, and even I've clicked on, you know, the errant fake phishing message to that they use to test you and fail. I got a weird phishing message as a text message the other day that said, you know, I had a delivery at the post office that wasn't going through and they needed me to come and get it.
Oh,
and I
yes,
sent a screenshot yes. of it to my friend who works for the Postal Service. And she was like, yeah, this one's really getting a lot of people. So I'm half full because it's rough out here in these cyber streets.
Yeah. And, you know, a few years ago, David Brancaccio and the Morning Report crew did this great series on aging and the brain and how we, as we age, become more susceptible to these kinds of attacks.
The scams,
we just aren't as
quickly
absolutely. Able to recognize them. And so I do think training is good, especially as the scams adapt and evolve.
Yeah. And a lot of people are pointing out in the chat that the Marketplace Tech had a story about the AI writing the phishing emails now, which can make it just so much
course,
more sophisticated.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, and lots of people have gotten the UPS text as well. USPS text. All right, Daniel, what's the next one?
Number four, are you half full or half empty on the celebrity tequila boom?
Go ahead, Amy.
If I were a celebrity, I would have my own tequila. I mean, what else are they supposed to do to make money?
Especially during the actor strike. Well, a lot of them are on, what is that thing, Cameo, where you can get people to
that's
do
true.
Little
yes,
videos for you. So celebrities and tequila. I like tequila. I'm mediocre on celebrities, so half empty because I don't want to get
celebrities.
Well, look, because I always worry that when you have these big celebrity branded liquors or wines or whatever, are you crowding out, you know, sort of the craftspeople who would otherwise have space on the shelf with a really unique product with just sort of the branding? But, you know, it doesn't matter that
much. Hopefully they benefit from some of these partnerships, because we know they're not like brewing their own tequila, right? They're partnering
that's
with
true
some, hopefully. I would say I'm half empty too, just because, like, do they really need more money?
Some of them clearly do. So half empty. Good point. This next one is the poll, right, Daniel?
That's right.
Oh,
and,
good.
The last one is...
So wait one second. Mm-hmm. So for people, I'm sorry, I was just laughing because somebody in the chat said, I feel about tequila the way that Kimberly feels about gin. It is the devil. I'm so sorry, Jason. Anyway, for the poll, if you're watching in the YouTube live stream and you're in the chat and able to participate, Amy and I are going to vamp for a minute or two without hopefully giving too much of our opinion while we tally the votes. And so go ahead, Daniel.
All right. The last one, if you're half full or half empty on the quote unquote last Beatles song that was made with AI.
Oh,
I think we just learned what Amy feels.
I let out a noise. Ignore my noise.
And you made a face. And you made a face. You know, it's... I like some Beatles songs, but I'm not just like the person who's like, the Beatles are everything and always the best of the world of all history of music. And I appreciate what a movement it was for some segments of, you know, the population, but not everybody. I'm always surprised at their longevity, you know, and their ability to hang on and still draw crowds. And I wonder, you know, ABBA recently did another song where they kind of used an AI assist for the video, I think it was.
Were they touring then, somehow with AI? I can't remember exactly the story. I may be conflating two things, but yeah.
But I do think that it's, and some folks in the chat are suggesting this as well, I think that sometimes a gimmick like this can serve to introduce a new generation to some music that they might really like and that is interesting and gives them sort of a sense of a time period that they haven't experienced. And so, you know, if it makes some people who might not have ever listened to the Beatles, you know, give the music a shot for the first time, I think that's cool. I haven't actually heard the song yet.
I was going to say, like,
go back and listen to it.
So I don't know this story. I missed this while I was in the podcast episode churning cave.
People are telling me to lower our expectations.
Yeah. So was it... Daniel, was it an actual Beatles song that was released with the help of AI, or was it actually written by AI in the style of the Beatles?
I believe it's essentially a mashup of sort of the Beatles, the four original Beatles, you know, voices and such.
Wasn't it like a song that they wrote, and so they were able to get the voices because of AI?
Something like that, okay. Yeah. It's them, but AI sort of brought it home, as it were.
Okay, so Adam in the chat says, it wasn't made by AI. It was based on a demo by John. AI assisted in filling in the gaps. And they used AI to separate his voice from the other noise. Brett says they used AI to uncover Lennon's voice from the piano. And lots of people... John wrote it, says Barbara.
There's some knowledgeable folks
in the chat. I love how we're
getting
the whole narrative in the chat. Thanks. Oh, but Gigi asks a good question. Who's getting the copyright for the song? Interesting.
Yeah, right.
Okay, let's go ahead
and
close this
poll. Do we have the results?
We will in a second, but are you half full or half empty, Amy?
I am half empty because, I mean, I think it's an interesting experiment, actually, to bring something to life that we couldn't, you know, have. And, you know, I am a Beatles fan. I'm interested to hear it. But I do just worry about, you know, the creators, at least John, isn't here to say how his voice is used and how his music and his art are controlled. And so it sounds like Yoko was actually on board with this, given what somebody said in the chat, but I don't know. I feel like it doesn't feel right. It's just a gut half empty. That's what it is, folks. How about you?
Half empty on sort of the song and the, you know, sort of gimmicky nature of it. But a bit half full on the technology, simply because I also am worried about creators and their ownership of their music. But I also do think there's a really unique opportunity to use AI in music, like, you know, take, you know, how would, you know, Mozart interpret a Beyoncé song? You know, you could ask AI to do that, and that could be fascinating and fun. And there's a lot of opportunity to play around that I think could be interesting if we can set up some guardrails that protects creators, because I also think that there needs to be some things that are special, you know, and some of what makes music timeless is the fact that it exists in a time confined by what was happening in that time. And I worry that if we take people's voices and music and ideas out of their time and their experience and just mess around with it in with AI, we lose some of the magic of the music. So half, fully half, but that, I don't know. That's, yeah, that's what I've got.
You know, I was just thinking
the
about
poll results.
Oh yeah. What are the poll results?
So, right. Half empty, 65%, half full, 34%, with 161 votes on the last Beatles song made with AI. Most people seem to agree with you, Amy.
I was just thinking about something an old journalism professor of mine said, which is you can get away with anything as long as people know what they're getting. So I do think, you know, if you disclose what's been done, how it's been done, so people aren't fooled into thinking this is something authentic, you know, maybe play with the technology, see what you can get.
Yeah. All right, that is it for us today. If you have a question or a comment you want to share with our team, you can leave us a voicemail at 508, the letter U, the letter B, smart, or email us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. I love how that's like your thing. Yes, you're the only one.
I love that I have a thing.
You do.
Make Me Smart is produced by Courtney Bergseeker. Today's episode was engineered by Jake Cherry. Our intern is Niloufar Shabandi.
The team behind our Friday game is Emily McCune and Antoinette Brock. Marissa Cabrera is our senior producer. Bridget Bodner is the director of podcasts. And Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital and on demand. I'm so happy to see you, Amy.
You too. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you. I'm running, walking a 5K tomorrow, and I'm going to catch up on all the How We Survive episodes.
Oh, sounds good. You might need to walk slowly.
I probably will.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Jerez, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.